Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James and William Fink here for another installment of the Two Seed Line story saga, which is definitely the one of the main teachings of the Bible and the only possible explanation for the events of Genesis chapter 3, where everything focusing and revolving around Genesis 3:15, where Eve was literally seduced by Nahash and gave birth to Cain. Before I get into, I'm going to quote from a couple of anti-seed liners. Before we go any further, do you have any comments on things we've been discussing up to this point, Bill?
No, I don't. You know, I don't know how they don't see it.
And right.
It's without two seed line, the entire Bible is gibberish. Never mind the first couple of chapters.
Right, right. Yeah, certainly there's a the Bible does indeed talk about different genealogies. And you certainly cannot understand Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3 without reference to these genealogies. And the fact that there are people known as Canaanites who have a separate genealogy from that of the Israelites and certainly the Judahites, you know, who lived in Palestine in the time of Jesus Christ. So we definitely have to understand that there are the good seed and the evil seed. And that's exactly what Genesis 3:15 is telling us, that there's a good seed and an evil seed, and there would be enmity between these two people, or these two seed lines, forevermore, at least until the day of judgment, when their destruction, the destruction of the evil seed, is prophesied. Okay? Let me quote here. This is from CARM, Christian Apologetics and Research Ministry, .org. Two additional distinguishing and erroneous doctrines of the Shepherd's Chapel are known as the Serpent Seed Doctrine and the Kenites Doctrine. These are intimately related. Of course they are, because the Kenites are the descendants of Cain. The Serpent Seed Doctrine is the teaching that in the Garden of Eden, the serpent, the devil, had sexual relations with Eve. The result was that she bore Cain. The descendants of Cain are called Kenites. Abel, however, is the result of Adam and Eve having relations. Arnold Murray, the pastor of Shepherd's Chapel, is the primary advocate of these doctrines, which he adamantly teaches and which his followers have adopted as biblical truth. Mr. Murray states, quote, "When you look for the in-depth meaning of men as trees walking, you are able to see that Christ wants us to understand that there are plantings of God and plantings of the devil. The plantings of that wicked one began in the Garden of Eden with the conception of Cain and followed down through his progeny, the Kenites." Now, it's interesting that Arnold Murray, and I've been a follower and he used to receive his newsletter way back in the 80s, he does talk about Kenites, but he never identifies them, or at least he hasn't recently, never identifies them with Jews. Don't you think that's a mistake?
Well, it's a huge mistake because it's definitely a lineage given in the Old Testament,
mm-hmm,
from Cain through the Kenites, through the Canaanites,
yes,
all the way down to the Edomites and the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yes, simply no doubt about it. It's, I think we've mentioned this point in previous episodes, that the genealogy of the Canaanites and Kenites is not given in one neat package as the seed line of Israel is in Matthew 1 and Luke 3. However, if you read the Bible carefully enough, you will find the genealogy does, in fact, exist, okay? Now, this author here, let me just continue with a couple more sentences here. Of course, he says, "Of course, I disagree with Mr. Murray in his analysis. We do not really know exactly what form Satan was in the garden, though while I will submit to God's word and affirm that it was a snake of some sort." Can you believe there's actually someone who actually believes it's a literal snake?
Well, this person is still a child.
Yes.
And still believes in the child's tales that our medieval ancestors made up in order to explain Genesis 3 to children.
Yes, yes.
It's about time we grew up and stopped drinking milk.
Right. Exactly.
It's about time we were weaned.
Yes, right, exactly, exactly.
And Satan appears as an angel of light. Mm-hmm. Why would Paul say that?
Right.
Why would Paul talk about Eve's seduction and equate it with virginity?
Right, exactly, exactly. Continuing here, the word serpent is nachash and means serpent or snake, but of course he's only giving a partial definition. The word nachash in the Hebrew means enchanter, whisperer, deceiver. It also means those things in addition to snake. Again, you have to check with the context to make sure that you got the right definition. Continuing, if we take the word literally and it means snake, then Mr. Murray would be forced to explain how a literal snake. Of course, he didn't say that, so he's not forced to explain anything along these lines. Let me continue though. If we take the word literally and it means snake, then Mr. Murray would be forced to explain how a literal snake could have sexual intercourse with Eve. But of course, Mr. Murray isn't asserting any such thing. This is the guy. So yeah, I want people to see the kind of logic these people use. Number one, they force their own definition upon us, okay, and therefore it doesn't make any sense. Well, of course it doesn't make sense if we take your definition of it, and we're not saying, and Mr. Murray has never said that it's a literal snake, okay? Nachash is not a literal snake, now, certainly not in Genesis chapter 3. Continuing here, if Mr. Murray were to acknowledge the potential of a figurative usage of the term here, then he needs to explain why the term serpent would be figurative and the term seed would be literal. Well, of course, the word tree. I think we discussed the fact that the word tree, which represents family trees, there's a literal and figurative usage of that word in chapters 2 and 3. And you have to rely on the context, okay? So then he says, it's simply obvious from Genesis 4:1 that it can only mean one thing. He says this, quote, nevertheless, his entire position is easily refuted when we examine Genesis 4:1, quote, now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man child with the help of the Lord. We can see that the Bible clearly tells us who the father of Cain is, Adam. The serpent seed idea is proven wrong. So the anti-seedliners want to say that Genesis 4:1, as translated, is conclusive, and there's no, you know, the way it's translated here in the King James simply means that there's no other possible interpretation. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond that this turkey probably gets funded by the ADL.
Okay.
You know, Yahshua Christ tells the Edomite Judeans in John chapter 8, and they claim to be, they admit being Edomites by admitting that they, although they're Abraham's offspring, they've never been in bondage to any man.
Right.
He tells them that they're of their father, the devil.
Right.
And that the works of their father they will do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very plain, and either that's true or he's a slanderer.
Right.
Because you can't just make fly-by-night accusations at people. That's slander.
Yes.
And we have to believe that Yahweh come in the flesh came to slander people, or that is literally true.
Right.
Now, in Luke chapter 11, we have it recorded that he says that they're the children of, basically, the children of Cain, the children mm-hmm. of the people that murdered the prophets
right
from the beginning,
right.
From Abel. And their father was a murderer from the beginning, which can only refer to Cain.
Right. And therefore, he's not just the anti-seedliners will object to that interpretation and say, well, Jesus was only talking to this bunch of rabbis standing in front of him, the current generation, as it were, in front of him. And so, therefore, it cannot possibly apply to a seedline. But the fact is, how can he accuse people standing in front of him of murders committed 4,000 years previously?
Right, but that word generation should be translated race.
That's
and
right.
Race is definitely guilty of those murders.
Exactly.
And that's the way it is. Or Yahshua Christ is a slanderer.
Or he's
there
a liar.
There is no in-between.
Yes.
There's no other possible logical interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
He's telling the literal truth, or he's slandering those people.
That's right.
One or the other.
Yeah.
And there's no third explanation that's viable that'll stand up to any logical scrutiny.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly you cannot accuse someone, let's say today, of a crime that was committed 100 years ago.
Absolutely
know?
Not. But yes. you could accuse a race of it.
That's right.
You can accuse the English for suppressing the Irish for the last 400 years.
Yes.
As a nation, they've done that.
Yes.
And I'm not singling out the English. I'm half English myself. But I mean, a lot of peoples are guilty of wrongdoing over a continued period of time.
Right.
I mean, the Jews have been lying about the Holocaust for almost 100 years.
Sure. Sure. Yes.
It's endemic in a people.
Yeah.
And it can only be told unless it was true.
Right. So either Jesus was lying and saying, well, you people, are guilty of, you know, murder going all the way back to Cain and Abel, or, you know, he's talking about their whole race, their whole seed line, or he's lying to them.
Absolutely, and he couldn't have been speaking metaphorically because there's no metaphoric parallel. There's nothing that could be representing except the murder of Abel and all the prophets down through the years, through the centuries.
Yeah.
Unto the time of Zechariah. And that Zechariah isn't the son of Barachias. That's an addition to the manuscript.
Oh, really?
That Zechariah is almost certainly John the Baptist's father, Zechariah.
Right. Yeah, that's who I take it to be. Yeah.
And that's actually, it plays out in English, but it doesn't play out in Greek or Hebrew.
Interesting.
But that's all the prophets from A to Z.
Right. Certainly. Certainly. Yeah, right. And all the ones in between.
Right. That's my point.
Yes, exactly.
And when we look at the Old Testament, we have Doeg the Edomite killing the priest of Yahweh for Saul. We have Jezebel the Canaanite ordering the priest of Yahweh killed when she's Ahab's wife.
Mm-hmm.
We have Canaanites and Edomites killing the prophets and the priests of Yahweh.
Right.
And the story in between, I mean, I went right to the New Testament when you asked me for a response to this message,
mm-hmm.
But I did that to show that the entire context of the Bible demonstrates this. It's not just Genesis 3:15. It's not just a couple of passages here and there. It's from one end of the Bible to the other.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. It is a continuous theme that cannot be ignored. Ted Weiland, I'm going to be quoting from Ted Weiland's work here, he asserts the exact opposite. He says that there's no follow-up or no significance of Genesis 3:15 implied in the rest of the Bible. Okay, that's his assertion. But let me quote.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
The only parallel I could make in common sense is like we have this enemy and these people are denying it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're denying we have an enemy.
Yes.
And the New Testament and the Old Testament reveal over and over again that the children of Israel have enemies.
Yes.
These enemies are still in the world today. Where are they?
Yeah, exactly.
And why are they enemies?
Yeah, the parable of the wheat and the tares says exactly the same thing.
The only reason why we could have enemies, the same enemies,
yes,
we've had the same enemies for thousands of years. These people have infiltrated and usurped our governments.
Yes.
And it's clear all throughout history, and the only thing that explains that is Genesis 3:15.
Yeah, and then the wars between the Israelites and the Canaanites are a follow-up of Genesis 3:15.
Absolutely.
The struggles between when our ancestors came out of Egypt, who were the first people other than the Egyptians to attack our people? The Amalekites, who were part of Canaanite world, the descendants of Cain, okay?
Absolutely.
So,
Edom wouldn't let the Israelites pass through the borders.
Exactly. So even if you weren't a two-seedliner, the theme that there's an enmity between the Canaanites and the Israelites is unmistakable and right there in Scripture from beginning to end.
And it's absolutely evident. It's evident in Greek history. It's evident in Roman history. It's evident all down through the Middle Ages and through every period in history until today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Once you can trace the people and unlock the key to the Bible and the key to history, they're in absolute coherence with each other.
That's right. That's right. And the fact is that the anti-seedliners and those who don't care haven't paid enough attention to Scripture to figure out that this enmity that was declared by Yahweh in Genesis 3:15 is, in fact, a historical saga, an ongoing historical saga that if we pay attention to history, we'll realize that this prophecy is absolutely true and verifiable from the day that this prophecy was announced by Yahweh.
And the most clear example in recent times of the Jewish treatment, the Jewish infestation of Germany in the years leading up to World War I, and the way the Jews turned on Germany during World War I actively campaigned inside the country to have it defeated, and all the atrocity stories that have been made up ever since, World War I and World War II.
Right.
That's the enmity between the real Judah and the Edomite Jews is absolutely evident.
That's right. Yeah. And the fact that communism has been promoted by Jews from day one. Moses Hess, I believe, was the originator of both communism and Zionism. You know,
absolutely. And the Jewish Bolsheviks have been responsible for the deaths of maybe 30 to 50 million white Christians, both Rus and Slavs, inside of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I'd say closer to 100 million.
I mean, the numbers, the estimates all over the map, it was a lot of people. That was the real Holocaust.
That's the real Holocaust, exactly. I'm going to be quoting now from Ted Weiland's internet article entitled "Eve, Did She or Didn't She? The Seed Line Hypothesis Under Scrutiny, Part 1. And from his intro, he says this: in certain Christian circles, seed line is a doctrine derived from one passage, from one passage only in the Old Testament and a handful of passages in the New Testament. He must be talking about you, Bill. From these limited number of passages, it is concluded that the sin committed by Eve in the Garden of Eden was physically sexual adultery with Satan himself. Okay, now that's a bit of a stretch. There are certain seedliners who say it was Satan himself, but certainly it was a fallen angel. There's no doubt about that.
Well, any particular fallen angel or descendant of them
is
Satan.
Yes. Okay. And so, but he wants to limit it exclusively to Satan, and he doesn't want to...
Well, they have to make our doctrine sound as ridiculous as possible in order to satisfy the Jews that pay them to do this.
Right. Okay, so anyway, he's particularizing Satan and is not arguing against what we've been actually arguing, that it was a non-white male. Okay, and that's all that we need to have to prove...
Right, it was at the least, it was a non-white male.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So, he qualifies it, or with some humanoid from another race of people commissioned by Satan. Okay. That's very good. Very good. It is then deduced that from this sexual union between Satan and Eve, Cain was begotten, who in turn became the progenitor of a wicked seed line of people who exist down to this present day. Okay. So that's a pretty good summary of, what two seed line is consisting of. So I'm going to flip over here, to a section called Seedliner Speculation versus Scriptural Facts. And he says this: the seedliners assume much while at the same time rejecting what the scriptures clearly declare. Whereas the seedliners assume that Cain was a curse and the offspring resulting from a physical sexual relationship between Satan and Eve, it is a fact of scripture that Cain was a blessing from Yahweh and the firstborn son of Adam and Eve. Now, where does it state that Cain was a blessing?
It states nowhere that Cain was a blessing. Cain was a murderer.
That's right.
Over and over again. That's a theme in the New Testament.
Yes.
So Ted Whelan must be an antichrist.
Yeah,
because Joshua Christ says that Cain was a murderer, and Whelan's calling him a blessing.
That's right. Very good.
There's a serious disparity there with Scripture.
Yeah.
Ted Whelan must be a Jew.
Okay, well, I wouldn't go that far, but he's flirting with it. Okay.
If he's not a Jew physically, he missed a good opportunity.
Yeah, right. and then continuing, it says, in point of fact, and Adam knew, he's quoting Genesis 4:1, and Adam knew, and in brackets, had sexual intercourse with Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten a man-child from Yahweh, Genesis 4:1. And then he says, that could hardly be stated more plainly. Genesis 4:1 alone refutes the seedline hypothesis. However, I am committed to deal with all of the seedliners' major arguments so that there will be no doubts about any of them. Following are three interpretations by seedliners regarding what took place in Genesis 3. I'm going to avoid these three different interpretations. But I'm going to argue against his contention that Genesis 4:1, as stated in the King James Version, is irrefutably anti-seed line. Because the fact is that in Genesis 4:1, let me just switch to my Bible here, my King James Version, when it says, Weiland in another place asserts that Yahweh is declaring that that Cain is the son of Adam and Eve. And of course, Yahweh is not saying anything of the sort. Well, in Genesis 4:1, Eve is being quoted. And the end phrase of this verse is, I have gotten a man from Yahweh, okay? And that's Eve speaking, okay? It's not Yahweh speaking, it's Eve speaking. So as Eve is saying these words, we have to pay close attention to the fact that she's being quoted. This is not Yahweh speaking, this is Eve speaking. I have gotten a man from Yahweh, okay? Now this, of course, is dependent upon, what does Eve mean, okay? Now, first of all, the word man is not translated from the Hebrew Adam. It's translated from the Hebrew Ish. So if, in fact, Cain were a son of Adam, she would be saying, I have gotten an Adam man, not simply a man-child or a male offspring, from Yahweh. And also the word from is it's from the Hebrew eth, which is a very broad preposition that can mean from, by, for, and also can mean against. There are at least 16 instances where the Hebrew eth is translated as against instead of from.
I think that's just idiomatic. I really don't think that it can mean against except for context.
Okay.
I can dispute that. In other words, to fight with somebody is the way it's often translated.
Okay.
It's often translated to fight against somebody because that is the idiom in English.
Okay. Yes. And so, again, you do have to look at the context. Yeah. So in context, however, the word man cannot be assumed to be an Adamite. Simply cannot be assumed to be an Adamite. Because all she is saying here is that I have gotten a male kind, a man-child, as he properly translates it, man-child. I have gotten a man-child, but this word man is not translated from the word Adam, which you would expect if Cain were indeed a son of Adam. So,
well, right.
Yeah. So my point is that it's not conclusive. Genesis 4:1 is not conclusive because the word man does not imply an Adamite. It simply implies a male of the species.
Right. And I agree with what you're saying, but to me it's not conclusive simply because it's the verses, the Hebrew literal verses, demonstrably corrupt, as we covered last week.
Right. Yeah, we discussed that. But and then I would go to Genesis chapter 5. Verse 1, where we are given the genealogy of Adam, okay? This is the book of the generations of Adam, which means the offspring, the descent, the line of descent of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female created he them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam. Okay? There, the whole species is called Adam. And in Genesis 4:1, he is not called Adam.
And Cain's descendants are never called after
That's
Adam.
Correct. That's correct.
And Cain's
so,
descendants are never listed from Adam.
They're right. And the key phrase here in verse 1, in the likeness of God made he him. Okay, so that there is a likeness between God and the Adamites, which is totally absent from the descendants of Cain. Okay?
And it seems that Genesis 5 is... It portrays a reparation and a recovery from events which occurred in Genesis 4.
Mm-hmm, yes.
More than just Seth replacing Abel and not Cain, of course.
Right.
And the entire theme of the chapter seems to be a revival, more or less, from the events described in Genesis 4.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, and then, let's just keep going from Genesis 4:1 and verse 2. And she again bore his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So we're basically just being told the occupations that Abel and Cain had at the time, okay?
Yes. Now, there's something I'd like to discuss about 4:1 before we move on.
Oh, okay, sure.
And that's just, we maintain that Eve was pregnant from another being and bore Cain.
Mm-hmm.
And pregnant from Adam and bore Abel. And I just want to demonstrate this to show that such a myth was extant in the ancient world and in other forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be quoting the Shield of Heracles by Hesiod, who
okay.
wrote about probably a little after 600 BC. And it's one of the earliest Greek poems. Hesiod's considered the earliest Greek writer except for Homer.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest Greek epic poet except for Homer, because there are a couple of pastoral poets who are older.
Okay.
And Hesiod, in explaining the pregnancy of Alcmena, the daughter of Electryon, and the birth of Heracles, and Heracles had a twin brother.
Okay.
And Heracles was born from Zeus, and
yeah.
the twin brother was born from a mortal.
Right.
And Alcmena was pregnant with them both at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And Hesiod writes, so in one night Zeus shared the bed and love of the neat-ankled daughter of Electryon and fulfilled his desire, and in the same night Amphitryon, gatherer of the people, the glorious hero, came to his house where he had ended his great task. He hasted not to go to his bondmen and shepherd a field, but first went to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And such desire took hold of the shepherd of the people, and as a man who has escaped joyfully from misery, whether of sore disease or cruel bondage, so then did Amphitryon, when he had wound up all his heavy tasks, come glad and welcome to his house. And all night long he lay with his modest wife, delighting in the gifts of golden Aphrodite, and she, being subject in love to a god and a man, exceeding goodly, brought forth twins in seven-gated Thebe.
Yes.
Although they were brothers, these were not of one spirit. For
uh-huh.
one was weaker, but the other a far better man, one terrible and strong and mighty, the mighty Heracles. Him she bare through the embrace of Zeus, the son of Cronos, and the other Iphicles of Amphitryon, who's immortal.
Okay.
And this is, to me, this demonstrates that such a myth existed at the earliest times amongst
right.
our people.
Right, right.
And I don't think it's like the St. George and the Dragon story has carried down through centuries, over 5,000 years, basically. The same story is carried down. And I think that this is another example of the same. And there are other examples of that, like
oh, yeah.
Jack and the Beanstalk and the giants from heaven and all that.
Right.
But this is another example of the same phenomenon.
Right.
Where the Greeks believed that this woman had birthed to two sons, and one came from a god and the other from a mortal. And the Greeks were descendants. These Greeks are descendants of the Hebrews.
Right. Well, yeah, and another thing needs to be pointed out, too, because you know, we're talking about they're not twin brothers in the sense of having the same father, but twins occupying the same womb
right.
of different fathers.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And I just want to show that the myth exists in later times, and it had to come from somewhere.
Right. And that concept may seem unbelievable to some people. However, it is a medical fact that a woman can be pregnant by two different men, in fact, two different men of different races, at the same time.
Yes, that's been known to happen.
Yeah, and you know, a medical record proves that this is the case. Now, it's not common because up until recently, women tended to, be married before they, had children, okay, and typically married to only one man. It's only in modern history, the last 50 to 75 years, let's say, that women have slept around with multiple partners as much as they do today. So this was very much uncommon in the days when the King James Version was written. Okay, unheard of practically, if not in fact. So that, you know, a woman being pregnant by two men at the same time just didn't happen in those days, you know. And if it did, she never mentioned it. She never admitted it, okay. And most, in fact, I think the statistic is that somewhere around 15% of all cases where, you know, the parenthood, the fatherhood of a child is in dispute, it involves dual pregnancy, okay, where, you know, there's more than one man claiming to be the father, okay? So that it's, yeah, fraternal versus identical twins. And so fraternal twins can be fathered by different men. There's simply no doubt about this, okay?
We know it's possible, and that the myth also existed. So it's not improbable. It's not beyond probability.
Yeah, it's actually probable, you know. And it's certainly possible.
And so, Genesis 3 was certainly all about sex, so it certainly happened here.
Exactly.
And Genesis 4:1 is certainly, there are problems with this verse and its translation.
Right.
So that can't be used. That's the only verse that Ted Wieland and crowd use to disprove or in
Tragedy.
Their mind,
yeah.
two seed line.
Yes. Yeah.
And they go back to Genesis 4:1 every time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Clifton Emelheiser did an excellent job in his essay, The Problem with Genesis 4:1.
Right, right.
And that should be in every Christian Israelite's arsenal.
Yeah. And then, you know, as we're discussing, if we really pay attention to the genealogies, the significance of Genesis 3:15 cannot be overstated. As, let me put it this way, let me quote Ted Wieland here. If the seed line position is accurate, does it not seem a bit odd that such a consequential event is never mentioned again in the Old Testament? On the contrary, it's constantly being referred to. In fact, how could such a prophecy be uttered that there would be an enmity between two seed lines and it be of total inconsequence? You know, that doesn't make any sense.
And the enemies of Yahweh and of Israel all throughout the Old Testament happen to be related to the Kenites, Canaanites, and Edomites.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So that this proposition, far from being, ridiculous, is in fact profoundly significant and germane to the rest of the Bible. Absolutely, there's simply no doubt about it, okay?
And in the New Testament, and Paul says it, and he says it's spoken in several places that Yahshua Christ came to reveal things kept secret from the foundation of the world
mm-hmm.
or of the society. And that's absolutely true. Even though David in the Psalms consistently speaks of the sons of the wicked and several other idioms that he uses to describe them, it's basically never spelled out until we get to the New Testament. And it's definitely spelled out in the New Testament.
Yes, yes.
And Joshua Christ isn't calling these people devils and serpents for nothing.
Right, yeah. And also, as we have mentioned before, Genesis chapter 6, where it clearly states that fallen angels cohabited with the daughters of men. And there, the daughters of men is translated from the Hebrew, guess what? Adam. Okay.
Right. Yes, it is. And I have a paper that actually explains the term sons of God in Genesis chapter 6 should actually read sons of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And it does in some manuscripts of the Septuagint, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and in Enoch.
Yeah, and so that chapter alone refutes his contention that it's not mentioned anywhere else. Okay.
Right, that mixing of the races is not mentioned. It definitely is, right, in Genesis 6.
Exactly, and that's our main contention, that what that represents is race mixing, pollution of the Adamic seed, and without this idea of race mixing being forbidden, you really can't even understand the Bible. You know, it's just because this, as I quoted, this is the book of Adam, Genesis 5:1, the generations of Adam. And then, the Canaanites, who are enemies, are always mentioned tangentially as our people run into them throughout history, okay? But they are never considered to be part of our family, and they're always interpreted as being our enemies, never as our friends.
There's something I would like to say about the names Cain and Abel.
Okay.
And a lot of the commentaries And knowing the descendants of Cain, it makes a lot of sense. They try to relate the name Cain to 70, 80, I'm sorry, I can't even, the print's so small. the Hebrew numbers, to the Hebrew word Cana, which means to get or obtain.
Right, obtain.
I think the Strong's number is 7069.
Okay.
Well, Cain is number 7014 in Strong's Concordance, and it's the same exact word as 7013, which it's the same. It's a noun. It's just not a name in 7013,
mm-hmm.
for spear or lance.
Okay.
The word Cain means spear or lance.
Okay.
Now, the word Abel, by contrast, is from the Hebrew word for breath.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this bears a lot of meaning because the spear is a symbol of war.
Right.
And the breath, to me, goes back to Genesis 2:7.
Right.
Abel had the breath of life that Adam had.
Right, exactly.
And Cain didn't.
Yes.
Cain was named after a spear or a lance because that's a symbol of war, and that's the way I look at it.
Right,
and,
right.
And that, you know, Hebrew names were very important, and every Hebrew name meant something.
Right.
And we see so often in the Old Testament that the person's life and name very well coincided.
That's right.
And names were almost prophetic in a lot of ways.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
And Cain is a spear.
Mm-hmm.
And Abel is a breath.
Right.
And that can't be overlooked.
Yeah, and so that goes back to the similarity that Abel had the breath of life that was breathed into both Adam and Eve, but Cain did not have that breath of life.
And that's my point.
Right, exactly. Okay, all right, well, let's continue with Genesis chapter 4 here. Let me repeat verse 2. And she again bore his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And you just went through the meanings of the names, okay? And verse 3, and in process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to Yahweh. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And Yahweh had respect to Abel and his offering. Okay, now a lot of people wonder why wasn't Cain's offering accepted? And I think the clue is really here in verse 3. He brought of the fruit of the ground an offering, A-N, meaning any old offering, to Yahweh. But in contrast, Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. Now, isn't this reminiscent of the concept of the first fruits?
Well, yes. Right, but there's something else going on here.
Okay.
Why are they both making sacrifices?
Yes.
The oldest son is the family priest.
Mm-hmm.
As we discussed back when we talked about Melchizedek and the book of Hebrews and the Melchizedek and
correct.
The priesthood, it's clear from certain scriptures that there was a priesthood that went from father to oldest son,
right,
down the line all the way to the time of Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And this is apparent in the fact that Enoch is considered the seventh from Adam and Noah is considered the eighth preacher of righteousness. And,
mm-hmm.
and if you count the oldest male line down to Noah, he's the eighth one.
Yes.
And Cain and Abel here are both attempting to fulfill a priesthood, which it's clear in Scripture belongs to the oldest son.
Okay, yes.
In fact, Exodus 13:1-2, and Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, sanctify unto me all the firstborn, whosoever openeth the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of beast, is mine.
Yes.
The firstborn son is sanctified to Yahweh to be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Adamic tradition.
Right. Okay.
In Numbers 3:12, it's explained that the Levites are taken to be priests in exchange for the firstborn.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
And here we have two sons, and only one of them's firstborn of Eve.
Right.
They're both vying for this priesthood.
Right.
It appears to me.
Yeah.
They're
okay.
Both making sacrifices. When only one of them should be making sacrifices.
Okay.
If Cain were legitimate, could legitimately be a priest to Yahweh, Abel wouldn't be making a sacrifice.
Right.
At
yes.
all.
Yes.
And Cain's sacrifice can never be accepted because he's not Adam's son.
Right. Certainly not. Yes, yes. And the point I'm making is simply that, you know, the whole history of the traditions of the children of Israel is that the first offerings were always offered to Yahweh, and it was always a special select crop, you know, the cream of the crop that was selected, and usually, you know, the first fruits of every crop were the ones that were offered to Yahweh, you know.
Right.
And but Cain isn't offering that. He just picked up any old.
Well, any, apparently, yes.
Yes.
He just offers of the fruit of the ground.
Yes. Yes. So he was not seeking to make a special sacrifice. And certainly if his name means, in the common understanding, acquisition, and, you know, it could, by extension, it can mean greed, you know, but having, to have and to want to possess things. Then Cain wanted to possess the first fruits for himself. He didn't want to give them up to Yahweh, okay? So there's a whole, you know, in the meaning of the names, as you mentioned, Cain and Abel, there is a lot to be considered, okay? There's not just names like people name people, their children today, without even considering what the names mean, you know, but that's never true in the case of the Bible. The names of people are always very, very full of meaning, okay? All right, so let's continue here. But to Cain and to his offering, he had not respect, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And Yahweh said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, shall you not be accepted?" Okay, let me ask a question here. Is Yahweh asking a rhetorical question here? Because obviously Yahweh knows what Cain is going to be up to, okay, since he's all-knowing. And is he offering Cain, as you have implied, the priesthood? Or is he simply saying, well, I mean, it's up to you, Cain. What are you going to do?
I believe that it's a rhetorical question.
Okay.
It's my opinion that this is the same rhetorical question that Paul asks the Edomite king, Herod Agrippa. I think it's in the end of Acts. It
uh-huh.
may be in Acts 23, 24, 25, around there, where Paul asks him, "You do believe in the law and the prophets, don't you?"
Yeah. Yes.
and Herod very slyly gets out of it by retorting, "Oh, you almost persuade me to be a Christian."
Yeah,
it's
right.
The same type of question. Paul had Herod on the spot.
Yes.
Here Yahweh has Cain on the spot.
Right.
And
right.
and he knows that Cain can't do well.
Right.
And he has him in the corner.
Yes, yes. But he still has to ask him the question to see, you know, what his response is going to be, and whether, in fact, he can live up to his pretensions.
Right, but I think that's, you know, all Scripture is done for us as an
yes.
example.
Yes.
And Yahweh doesn't really care about Cain, except that you know, he's going to use Cain's descendants to chastise us.
That's right. That's right. That's for sure. That's for sure. So let's continue here. "And if you do not well, sin lies at the door." Now, what's the significance of "sin lies at the door"?
Well, Clifton, and it makes sense, and Clifton believes that this is the birth canal door.
Okay.
Which actually, the birth canal was equated to a door, to a delta, to a door by the Greeks,
mm-hmm.
and that idea exists, that
right.
the womb, the matrix,
yes, the
passing
matrix.
Through the matrix is the act of being born.
Right.
And that's the door into life. And,
yes.
And Clifton has written and believes that this is the door of the womb, that
yeah.
sin lieth at the door, and that, you know, Cain is sinful from birth. He's a mistake from birth. Sin
right.
is error.
Exactly.
Sin is error. The concept of sin is error or failure of purpose.
Yeah.
To miss the mark or to fail.
Right. And I didn't think of it before the show, but the King James does actually use the word matrix. "He that openeth the matrix" is a common expression in the Old Testament for, either being conceived or being born.
Yes, and that was to the Greeks the door to life.
Right, exactly. Okay, and continuing with verse 7, and to you shall be his desire, and you shall rule over him. Well, what's he talking? You shall be, and to you shall be his desire. It's like is personifying sin. Isn't
yes.
that okay?
It very well could be seen that way.
Yes. Okay. And so he is equating and personifying sin with Cain. And you shall rule over him. Sin. That's who you shall rule over. Okay. Rule over. Verse 8. And Cain. Go ahead.
At this point, I would like to say something, and this might be a long explanation.
Mm-hmm.
In Luke chapter 4, verses 5 to 7, Satan is tempting Yahshua Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And bringing him up, this is my own translation, I believe.
Okay.
And bringing him up, he showed him all of the kingdoms of the inhabited earth in a moment of time. And then the false accuser, or who is the devil or
yes.
Satan, said to him, I will give to you authority over all this and their honor, because to me it was delivered, and to whomever I wish I could give it.
Yes.
Therefore, if you would worship me, it shall all be yours. Here is Satan offering Yahshua Christ the world.
Mm-hmm.
Satan
yes.
rules the world.
Yes, he does.
John chapter 12, 31 to 33. Now judgment is of this society or world.
Mm-hmm.
Now the ruler of this society or the power of the Edomites and Kenites over the line of the woman
yes.
shall be cast out. John 14, 30. No longer shall I discuss many things with you, for the ruler of this society comes,
mm-hmm.
and he does not have anything in me.
Yes.
John 16, 7 to 11, or I'll just read verse 11. Then concerning judgment, because the ruler of this society has been judged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Paul
yeah.
in Ephesians 2, 1 to 2 talks about the same people when he calls them the ruler of the office of the air and the spirit
yeah.
now operating within the sons of disobedience.
Yeah. Well, I would have to say that not even Ted Weiland could deny that the Jews rule our society.
And here we have Cain.
Yes.
Thou shalt. Rule over him.
Mm-hmm.
You shall rule over the seed of the woman.
Yeah.
What's being told.
Right.
And this Cain, you see, Cain is not Adam's son.
Right.
But when Adam accepted Eve, he accepted Cain as his oldest son because Eve was his wife who happened to be pregnant with Cain.
Right. By adoption.
And Adam took her, so he's claiming whatever is in her to be his.
Right. And isn't it ironic that Joseph did exactly the same thing with Yahshua?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's an absolute parallel, and it's an absolute reversal of
yes.
fortune.
Exactly. It reverses what happened in the garden.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
And here we have it, and thou shalt rule over him. And this explains why Satan and his descendants rule the world.
That's
and,
right.
And they
that's
do
right.
under this day and under the second advent of Yahshua Christ.
Yes.
And Ted Weiland can't get past those verses, too.
Right. Well, that certainly can't be metaphorical because Satan is the prince of this world, as the Bible clearly says.
Over and over again.
Yes. And so he was the de facto slash is the de facto ruler of this present world order. There's
absolutely.
No doubt about that.
And that's Cain, and that's the seed of the serpent.
Right, yeah. And even the anti-seedliners admit that the Jews rule over us.
And right, and they admit two seedline, but they just don't want to admit Genesis 3.
Yes, exactly.
They profess our belief all the time, but they don't see it written right in front of their eyes.
That's right. They don't want to they don't want to admit there was a sexual seduction.
You know, the enemy was here. The fallen angels were here before Adam was put here.
That's right.
They didn't become dangerous to us until we mix with them.
That's right.
That's when they become dangerous to us.
Right.
That's when they become a danger
right.
of destroying us.
Yeah. Now, let's take Satan's offer to Yahshua. Let's consider that a little more closely because obviously Yahshua being the Son of God, Yahweh in the flesh, there's nothing Satan could offer him. you know, not to Yahshua or Yahweh, but certainly it is a temptation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's all Satan can offer us, is worldly things.
I mean, it's worth a try, isn't it? This is my only shot. I might as well give it a try. And what did Jesus do? He quoted Scripture.
Well, that's also a reversal of what happened in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Because Eve fell for it.
Right. Yeah.
Joshua didn't.
Exactly. Exactly.
Believe the lie.
Yes. Exactly. So we have this, and also, if you take the Satan's or the adversary's words to Yahshua at that point, certainly it would be true that he could offer the world, you know, to anybody at that point. But it's still a lie, because he's not going to give anything up. Satan doesn't operate that way, you know. He will not give up his own rulership to anybody else. He demands to be in control. And we see that over and over again with Jewish relationships with other people. When they come into our nations, typically our Anglo-Saxon nations, every single time they infest our society, they rise over above us, primarily through usury and through cunning and deception. They take over our societies and begin to rule over us.
Well, we could see it in our own political system, just about every administration. I mean, the exceptions might be Coolidge and Hoover.
Uh-huh.
Every administration since Woodrow Wilson has had Jews running the White House, yes, with Jews working in the background running things.
That's right.
Look at this clown that's in office now.
That's right.
Look
Rahm
at
Emanuel.
George Bush.
Yeah.
And it's more and more conspicuous today. But, I mean, this has been going on for 100 years.
Right, right. Yeah, and the Roosevelt administration was just littered with Jews, with Zionists,
right,
and communists, all
but
up and
so
down.
So was Clinton's, and so was, I mean, John,
right,
Kennedy might be an exception also.
Yes, yes.
But all the others have been absolutely littered with Jews, yeah.
Yeah,
look
certainly.
Look at Henry Kissinger and Nixon. Look at Henry Kissinger and,
yeah,
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, Johnson, LBJ. LBJ was part Jewish. And he fraternized with Jews constantly. So, there's no doubt about it. And Eisenhower was, in fact, Jewish. Okay. So, you know, our various administrations have literally been run by Jews, and if not by actual Jews, the second in command very often, and certainly all the unelected advisors, such as Kissinger, okay, such as Bernard Baruch, and people like that, have always been sitting right next to the left hand of the president.
Look at Rahm Emanuel today.
That's right. That's right. And so you really have to have closed eyes not to see this. Okay?
Satan rules the world.
That's right.
And Satan was cast into the dungeon for 1,000 years. That's behind us.
That's right.
And that happened with Constantinus II and ended with the dawn of the Enlightenment.
Okay.
And ever since the Enlightenment, Satan has gone out to deceive the nations.
Yes.
So the power of Satan was broken for a while in Europe when the Jews were excluded from Europe. I mean, we still,
right,
had our wars.
Sure.
But Europe was Christian. And it was steadfastly Christian, as all of the lost Israelites were being converted to Christianity.
Right, yeah, and the Jews were actually confined to ghettos and did,
right,
not have the influence in our society that they do today.
Right, they didn't have the usury and all of that out in society, because Christian, we didn't use money.
That's right.
We don't need money.
Yeah,
we,
yeah,
think we need money because we think we need stuff.
Because we think like Jews.
Right.
The Jews have taught us to think like
that. Because
that's
the way we've been raised up.
That's right.
In a properly running Christian society, we really don't need money.
Yeah, the old saying is he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Today, he was born with a credit card in his mouth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, so our people, whether they realize it or not, are subject to the Lord of this world, who is Satan.
Right.
And personified by the Jew.
Absolutely.
And yes.
People look for justice in government, and they want to reform government, and it's all a sham. You can't do it.
That's
the only,
right,
thing you can do is to return to Yahweh and be obedient to Yahweh and pray for his coming.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, verse 8. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. So if these two people were, you know, and you pointed out that the difference in spirit is contained in their difference in names, then, and if Cain means spear, then and Abel was a sacrifice. So Cain, Abel was the first sacrifice of the Jews, the first victim the Jews sacrificed on this planet. Isn't that the case?
Well, the first Adamic victim, I'm sure.
Yes, right, certainly, yes. Because we both agree that these fallen angel people were on this planet before Adam and Eve were placed in the garden by Yahweh. So this
right, it can only be imagined from the Book of Enoch and from other apocryphal literature that they had raised havoc.
Yes.
Before then.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. Okay, verse 9, and Yahweh said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? Okay.
So here we have a liar from the beginning and a murderer from the beginning.
That's right.
This is in the New Testament, and this can only be wherever Yahshua says that of your father,
right.
Those people he was talking to had to be literal descendants of Cain.
That's right. And not figurative, spiritual, representatives of evil.
Well, that's what, you know, where it says, where John in his epistles, I think it's 1 John 3:12, I could be wrong, where John in his epistle says that Cain was of the wicked one, and that in the Greek syntax means that Cain was born or the son of the wicked one.
Right, certainly.
And there's nothing in Genesis that records that maybe he was a student of the devil.
Right.
And even if he was a student of the devil, well, then the Ted Whelans of the world would have to admit the devil was in Genesis anyway.
Right, exactly.
And they won't even go there because they deny the existence of a devil.
That's right. That's
most
right.
Of them.
Yes, most of them do.
Cain was the son of Satan, and that's it. There's no way around that without mental gymnastics and
yes.
All kinds of
without torturing the text.
Twisting of scripture, right?
Right. Okay. All right, verse 10. And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries to me from the ground. Okay, so this now really is the curse of Canaan being, you know, obviously the Jews are always denying, they always deny that they've ever done anything wrong. Okay? And here, isn't Cain setting this precedent? What have I done wrong? So what?
That's why they're of their father the devil, and the works of their father they will do.
That's right.
It's genetic. It's
mm-hmm.
congenital.
It's exactly. It's genetic. Verse 11.
Sin lies at the door.
Right, right. Yeah, and so anything born of a Jewess can only be evil. Verse 11. And now are you cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Okay, now, Ted Weiland says that there's never any mention again of this, you know, this enmity between the two seeds. Now, isn't verse 11 in chapter 4 a repetition of that same curse?
Absolutely.
Yeah. How else could this possibly be interpreted?
Absolutely. It's an expounding of the same curse.
Yeah. Now, I suppose you can say it only applies to Cain himself and not to his descendants.
Well, you know, in the Hebrew view of the world, the children suffered for the sins of the father.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had a sin that was carried down through your descendants, look at Ham's descendants.
Right.
Look at Canaan's descendants.
Yes.
And that's the way it was. What you did, was directly affected by all of your children.
Yeah, and because
the Jews' explanation, the Edomite Jewish exclamation at the crucifixion, his blood be on us
right.
And our children.
That's right. That's right. So it's never confined to one particular generation, nor is Genesis 3:15.
I will make war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Right, right. And then, now here, verse 12, this definitely differentiates Canaanites from Adamites. When you till the ground, it shall not hereafter yield to you its strength. okay? Is it not true that the Jewish people are known the world over for not farming?
Right. They only own the banks that control the farms.
Right.
No, Jews aren't farmers.
There's no such thing as a Jewish farmer. There ain't no such thing, folks. Never happened. Okay. A fugitive and a vagabond. Oh, and let me just quickly mention, because the Jews claim they made the desert blossom in Palestine. That's a bold-faced lie, folks. In my book, The Great Impersonation, I quote Mark Twain. When he visited Palestine well before the Jews invaded, he talks about how the land was blooming with orchards and, you know, all different kinds of, you know, and olive trees and what have you. And that it was the Palestinians who made the land bloom, folks, not the Jews. The Jews have bulldozed and destroyed more orchards than they've made. And the Jewish kids from New York City that are imported to, you know, the Middle East to work the farms, they grow sick and tired of that really fast. And it's actually Palestinians who do the actual farming, folks. It's not Jews, okay? So the rest of verse 12, a fugitive and a vagabond shall you be in the earth. Now, is it not true that throughout recorded history, the Jews have been fugitives and vagabonds, having been rejected by virtually every country that they have ever been resident in, and tossed out and becoming fugitives and vagabonds again?
They're tossed out of everywhere.
Yeah.
All the time, all through history.
Yeah.
And there's a direct correlation to a passage in Acts where Paul calls a certain Judean and a vagabond Jew.
Okay, right.
And it says a vagabond Judean, all right, in Greek, but
right.
But it's the correlation is certainly there.
Mm-hmm.
Why would Paul call this man a vagabond?
Right, right. Yeah, because they prey upon other people. They're essentially a ruthless people, because all other, let me put it this way, all bona fide races on the planet, they know how to live off the land, okay? They can actually grow food, most of them. You know, some of them are just hunter-gatherers, you know, especially in Africa. But certainly the Chinese know how to farm. They know how to do the rudimentary farming to feed themselves and have a stable, rooted culture. But the Jews have never had any such thing. They have always lived off the people of the land, not off the land itself. Is that not the case?
Absolutely. They're parasites on the people of the land. They infest the cities, and they use usury and gambling and prostitution to raise money.
Yes.
And take that money and pollute their neighbors.
Right, exactly.
They corrupt their neighbors.
Yeah,
and their power.
Right, and that's where you'll find the Jew. You'll find the Jew in the cities. You will not find the Jew in the countryside. You certainly won't find him on the land. And even the Talmud says that agriculture is the lowest position, the lowest occupation anybody can have. So, you know, so they're basically affirming this verse in Genesis chapter 4, verse 12, okay? All right, let's continue. Verse 13, and Cain said to Yahweh, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from your face shall I be hidden. And I shall be a fugitive, here's the fugitive and vagabond business again, a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth, and it shall come to pass that everyone that finds me shall slay me. Now, of course, this cannot be a reference to Cain, the individual, because he can only be slain once. So, isn't this kind of another congenital reference?
Well, this seems to indicate not only him, but whatever descendants he has,
yes.
Whatever children. Yes, and it seems to indicate that.
Sure. Yes. Okay. Because
the simplistic childlike view of the Bible dictates right here that there are only three people on the whole planet.
Right. Right.
And that's not possible either.
Right. And in fact, that's the position that Weiland assumes in criticizing Two Sea Lion. He asserts that there's only Adam, Eve, and the serpent. He says there's nobody else in existence on the planet. So Yeah, so his his position is very naive, very naive. Okay. All right, verse 15, and Yahweh said to him, therefore, whosoever slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. What's your take on this verse?
Well, this is almost an assurance that Cain is going to live to have children and multiply.
Right.
And if that doesn't happen, then the prophecy in Genesis 3:15 is vain.
That's right.
It surely is not vain, and Cain is going to have children to multiply.
That's right. That's right.
And this is sort of a guarantee to Cain that, don't worry, you'll be preserved.
Yeah.
Right. Yahweh cannot judge Cain because there aren't two or three witnesses to his crime.
Right. Yes. Yes. There's only Yahweh that witnessed to it. Right. And so he's not going to break his own law, which demands two or three witnesses. Yes. And so, also we have, I believe it's in the book of Jasher, I'm not sure, but it's preserved in the Talmud that, this sevenfold business might actually be a reference to a seventh generation. And there is the legend that seven generations after Cain, one of his own descendants killed him. And let's see, find the verse.
We have Cain, Enoch, Irad, Mahujal, Mahusael.
Yes, Mahusael, right.
And Lamech is supposedly
the
responsible for killing Cain,
right,
as told in the book of Jasher.
Okay, so it is in the book of Jasher. And apparently Lamech was out hunting and thought he saw was a ram or a goat, and he took aim and killed it. And then after he got close, he realized that he had actually killed Cain, his ancestor. Okay, so that's contained in the book of Jasher, and so that might be a possible explanation for what verse 15 really means. Okay, so
right. Well, in verse 23, Lamech admits killing somebody, and whether the book of Jasher is true or not, it says that it was actually at Tubal Cain, his son's guidance, that Lamech had slew Cain.
Okay,
by a hunting accident.
Yes. And then, and of course, and that's implied too in verse 24. Let me jump to verses 23 and 24. And Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hearken to my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding. Okay. So, in other words, he slew one of his own people.
And it says, if Cain be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold.
Right.
And this is, even if the book of Jasher is an invention of a contrivance by men, it's still a pretty good spin on what actually happened here.
Right, right. It gives us a historical context for what these words might actually be talking about, okay? So if he did slay a man, okay, which is what verse 23 says, then it's very possible and plausible that that man was Cain himself, okay? And that's a very interesting story. You know, if you're not familiar with the book of Jasher, then you would simply be guessing as to what this could possibly mean, okay?
Right, but I must issue caveats about the book of Jasher. There are clearly, whether they're interpolations or additions to whatever the original book of Jasher looked like,
mm-hmm.
there are clearly things in the book of Jasher that are fairy tales.
Right, okay. All right, so back to verse 15. And Yahweh set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. So if this was some kind of mark, it would have to be some kind of mark of respect, because wouldn't they be fearful of engaging him to try to kill him?
Well, I'm not going to conjecture what the mark may be, but yes, it seems that it has to be some.
Yeah, I know Bertrand Comparé says it's a hooked nose.
Right, and I wasn't really going to go there. But
yeah, right.
Whether that's true or not is only conjecture.
Right, right. But certainly something that was recognizable to people and more than likely fearful. You know, now if his name does mean spear, and, you know, he would have been a fearsome person, and people would not have engaged him, likely would have had some sort of fear and respect for him. Okay, verse 16. And Cain went out from the presence of Yahweh and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Okay. Any comments on verse 16?
Well, the land of Nod just means wandering, and as I've explained, Eden is the Semitic word for the steppe.
Okay.
And this could be any one of a million places. I'm not going to try
right.
to project it where it is.
Right, yeah. Okay. All right, so now verse 17. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. Now, this is the famous question where every student of Scripture who is told that there are only three people on the planet, and of course there were five because Cain and Abel were alive, but then Cain killed Abel, and now there's only four. Where does the wife come from?
Right. This is it's clear that there are other races on the planet.
Right.
It's clear from many places in Scripture.
Yeah.
There are other so-called races or people on the planet
mm-hmm.
that aren't Adamites.
Right, right. And so that's who he picked his wife from. And she conceived and bore Enoch, and he built a city, of course. You got to have more than two people to have a city. And called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. Okay, so we're definitely talking about the multiplicity of people. Verse 18.
Well, let me just say real quick that there are several apocryphal Hebrew books, like the Book of Adam and Eve
mm-hmm.
and the Book of Jasher, that say that Cain and Abel had sisters to marry,
mm-hmm.
and that's I'd classify those as fairy tales.
Okay.
As either interpolations or fairy tales. They're not true. That's,
mm-hmm.
It's a violation of Yahweh's law, first, to marry your own sister by the same parents.
Right, right, yes. And, and then even in the case of Noah and his wife, I know a genealogist who proved that you have to have eight people to avoid incest. And he showed me the charts, and so it's kind of a little too complicated for today's discussion, but you have to have at least eight people to avoid incest, and that's why Yahweh left Noah's family with eight, okay? All right, so verse 18, and to Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mehujael, and Mehujael fathered Methusael, and Methusael fathered Lamech. Okay, so we were given the line of descent here through Cain. Now, is there any connection between these descendants of Cain with the descendants of Adam?
No, it's amazing that Ted Whelan could claim that Cain is Adam's son and insist upon that.
Mm-hmm.
There is no indication anywhere that the Kenites and the children of Cain are related to Adam.
Right, right.
And it would be a first in the genealogy of the Bible.
Right, yeah.
Cain was not Adam's son.
Mm-hmm.
To not have them included here.
Yes. And so it's certainly, and again, getting back, for example, to this discussion of names we had earlier, names are very significant. And Yahweh, if a fact is left out, that's significant. If a fact is brought to our attention, that's significant. Cain is not spoken of as having Adam as his father. The Bible simply does not say that.
No, it only says his father's the wicked one.
That's right. And is that Adam?
Absolutely not.
If Weiland is correct, then Adam must be the wicked one.
And that's not true.
That's right.
That would be a slander to make that claim.
That's right.
I mean, Adam sinned and he accepted Eve, but any one of us may have done that.
Right. Right.
In fact, I'd bet under the circumstances, it's highly probable that every one of us may have done that.
Right. Well, certainly it would have puts the man in a dilemma when his wife has conceived by another man. It certainly puts the man in a dilemma. Okay, verse 19. And Lamech took to him two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal, and he was the father of such as dwell in tents and of such as have cattle. Okay, so we're talking about, you know, the type of people being described here are your nomadic cattle drivers that dwell in tents, okay, not people who settle on land. Now, isn't this a fulfillment of the fact that the ground shall not yield for these Canaanites, for these Kenites?
Absolutely. They're probably looking for a way to work up some shekels to buy some vegetables already.
Right, right. Well, certainly they could, you know, pick up, you know, whatever the land has available, you know, to them, you know, as in the hunter-gatherer group. But certainly they do not settle down and farm the land. Okay, verse 21. And his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all such as handle the harp and organ. Okay, so they created, they were the first traveling minstrel show.
Yeah, well, that's vaudeville.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Making a lot of noise, attracting attention and charging for it. Verse 22. And Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of, and every artificer in brass and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Now, there's more going on here in verse 22. What's this word artificer? You know, obviously we're talking craftsmen, but isn't it true that these were the first artifacts of war, first instruments of war?
Yes, that's actually referred to directly in the books, in the Book of Enoch.
Okay.
And artificer in brass and iron, well, most of the brass and iron implements discovered in archaeology from the period are instruments of war.
That's right. That's right. So we have that these Kenites were the first devisers of warfare, and we're probably making a profit, even in those days, selling instruments of war to feuding tribes, okay?
And the Kenites, I wish I'd have dug it out for this lesson, and I failed because I didn't. But in his early teaching letters, Clifton Emmaheiser was covering the Egyptian history, and he describes an inscription found in Egypt of a branch of the Kenite tribe, and they're pictured with a bellows.
Right, right.
And that's the symbol of the blacksmith or
right.
the smith.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah, so that these scribes, they got around, and they obviously were being given here in these verses of people that wandering, you know, sellers of various devices. It's like they sound like gypsies. Sounds like the first gypsies, okay? And the gypsies have always been known to be devisers and schemers and plotters and what have you, okay? And players of musical instruments. Fascinating. Verse 23. And Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hearken to my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. So, again, we covered this earlier. He probably accidentally slew Cain, his ancestor. Verse 24, and the confirmation really is in verse 24. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. Verse 25, okay, now we get back to Adam. And here it seems to me that chapter 5 should have begun with this verse. But let me read verse 25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and called his name Seth. And Seth, of course, means replacement. And it's explained in the rest of the verse. For God, said she, has appointed me another seed instead of Abel, whom Cain slew. Now, isn't Eve saying to her husband Adam that Seth is the replacement seed for Abel and Cain has nothing to do with it?
Right. And Cain obviously isn't in the family's plans for the future anyway.
That's right. So he's an outsider from this point on. He's a total outsider, having nothing to do with the Adamites forevermore.
Except to haunt them and taunt them and,
right.
and oppress them and murder them and everything else they've done for the last 7,000 years.
Yeah, okay. I see I have a caller. I had to log off and log back on because I lost my connection. So I'm not sure if I can I see Gary in San Diego is trying to call in, but I'm – oh, there we go. Gary, you there?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, how about it? It worked.
Yeah. Well, I just waited until you called on me.
Yeah, because we got one verse to go, so we got about 10, 15 minutes we can discuss this. Yeah, your question or comment?
I want to go back a little bit. You said that the Canaanites or the Jews are not farmers.
Right.
Now, I'm going to have to disagree with that.
Okay.
And you're going to have to agree with me. I know you both will when I say this.
Okay.
First of all, I've been over here in Mission Valley here in San Diego. It used to be all farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all shopping malls.
Right.
Okay, and it's got all kinds of subdivisions in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way they farm.
Right.
Because, you see, they put a subdivision there with a lot of people, and the people come into the shopping mall and spend their money in the shopping mall, and then you know, just keep circles that way, and the Jew sits there, and he collects his means off of that.
Oh, of course.
Well, you know, in the Roman world, the Jews were farmers, too. They were tax farmers.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
They do that, too.
Right.
You know, as you sit there, and there's another thing that I think was Bill said, that they were something about cattle. When we're going through and...
Yeah, drivers of cattle, yes.
Okay, that was one of them. Now, a lot of your meat packaging houses,
right,
and cattle is the Jews.
That's right.
That's,
well, they buy up the sources of food, and they control the markets. Just
right.
Like they control the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. They control all of our commodities,
yeah,
and they oppress our farmers because they can't get a fair price for their grain.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so, and that goes back to the definition of the word Cain as being acquisitive, acquisition. They always acquire the rights to sell everything.
Well, you see, like I said, the reason I bring it up, because I don't know how it is in Chicago or where Bill's at.
Bad.
But I do know that here in San Diego.
I'm in New York.
Yeah.
Oh, New York.
Yeah, right.
You go on the places used to be giant farms here.
Yeah.
You know, big tomato fields, big bean fields,
mm-hmm,
and all of that around here, you know, or stuff like that that grows. All those, you know, green peppers.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, all that. All that is now subdivisions built, you know, tract homes,
mm-hmm,
built by the Jews.
Yeah. So if anything, the Jews destroy farmland.
They do.
Yes.
So that's why I think I was a little sarcastic when I said they farm in a different method.
Right.
But it just goes to show you what they will do.
Right.
They take stuff that we lived off, then they force us into their cities.
Yes. Right. Right. Yeah.
Because now if you guys remember, you guys said that Cain went into Nod, and then in Nod he built a city.
Yeah, right.
Okay, now that in my mind made me think a minute, wait a minute, who always builds all the cities?
Yes. Right, right. Right. Well, how's the song go? How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry?
Yeah,
the Jew who wrote that song, no doubt.
Well, the Jews build the cities.
Yes.
Within the cities is where you get your
harlotry. Well, actually, no, that's, let me correct you there. The Jews do not build the cities.
Well, they finance.
We build the cities, and they add the subdivisions. they add, you know, they disenfranchise us whites by moving blacks and Latinos and Asians,
yeah,
in, forcing white flight, and therefore they make more profits on real estate.
Well, that's how they do it here. For instance, there was a place here was old, and the people were settled down, and they'd been there for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the time, it was real estate, I said, they're going to move you guys out of here. No, they ain't. We've been here for years. How are they going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
I says, I'll tell you what. Within just a short time, you're going to see HUD housing going in over here.
Right.
And I says, and when you have all them blacks running around stealing out of your house,
yes,
stealing your daughters, guess what you're going to do?
That's right.
Well, you know, it happened.
Yeah.
You know, I was sitting there sort of being a little BS with that, I thought, but it really happened that way. And these guys moved. So
yes,
now all the blacks and the Mexicans took over that neighborhood. So when they want a neighborhood like where we live right now, it was, you know, upper middle class whites, but now they want to chase us out of here because they got other places where they
right,
want us to buy.
Right.
So now they're putting in tons of HUD apartments.
Yeah, right.
And next thing you know, you'll have blacks running everywhere.
Right.
It's a little harder for them now because they've made us get used to the blacks.
And yeah. And plus, we're running out of room, too.
Well, the white daughters are laying with the blacks.
Right, right. And that's all part of the plan. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But that's how they change and keep this subdivision thing going, because they keep bringing in, you know, they're running out of blacks. That's why they brought in Mexicans everywhere.
Right, right.
Do what they're doing. Now, who wants to live next door to?
Yeah, the blacks weren't disenfranchising us fast enough, so they had to have the illegal aliens.
Yeah, because nobody wants to live in those neighborhoods. I mean, if you come here, all the Mexicans are. You know, I know in Chicago,
yeah,
we've got the same thing. I mean, it's like, it's terrible.
Right.
Weeds growing everywhere. They got 40 cars parked in the front yard.
Right.
I mean, it's unreal. You got five families living in a house. It's really sad.
That's,
you know,
right. That's it. It's part of the Cain versus Abel, or Cain versus Seth, Cain versus the Adamites story. It's a never-ending story.
Well, the whole issue is like in this United States right here. Well, what's going on? Well, we have been overtaken by Cain, and the issue here is Esau,
mm-hmm,
against Jacob.
Yeah, who was a race traitor, became a Canaanite, yes.
Okay, now we are sitting here watching Esau start to take, he has taken over,
mm-hmm,
Jacob's land, all of it.
That's right.
All through Europe, Australia, South Africa.
Well,
you
what
it.
That is that's the fig tree that was withered in full bloom.
Mm-hmm.
When you see the tree shoot forth its branches, know ye that summer is nigh.
Right.
Harvest is near.
Right. That's also a fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaac. When Esau demanded a blessing, he told Esau, well, you, by your sword shall you live. But the day will come when you shall break Jacob's yoke from off your neck.
Yes.
Yes. And that's when the Zionists created the bandit state of Israeli. And
Jacob's trouble.
Exactly. And then brought in the time of Jacob's trouble. So, again, here we have the Canaanite seed making war against us all over again in fulfillment of Isaac's prophecy.
The problem, I mean, one of the biggest problems is that the people that are trying to spread the truth are being hampered by clowns like Ted Weiland that insist that we don't have an enemy.
Right.
Well, isn't Ted Weiland, his name sounds very Jewish.
Well, I don't know about that.
Like I said, if he's not a Jew, he missed a good opportunity. He
yeah,
should have
right.
Been.
Right.
Well, I know that you mentioned Ted Weiland. You know, a lot of people don't like Pastor Peters.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's
you
another one.
But I'll tell you what, you want to hear Pastor Peters go off, mention Ted Weiland around him.
Okay.
He goes,
well, right. Ted Weiland should be a Jew, and Pastor Peters should be a Negro. He embraces them. He brings them into his congregation. He laws their abilities.
There's a story on that, because I was watching when that happened. And what happened is he opened up where he has his camp thing.
Okay.
And what happened is he went down there before that, and he says he wanted some Christian minstrels, and what he was going to do was allow them to come in and sing in his facilities there.
The minstrel was black, or didn't he?
Well, see, what happened is all of a sudden this black guy comes in, and Pastor Peters says, you know, and he even had a white woman, and he says, we don't go for this.
I have it on tape on Clifton Emmaheiser's website. I posted it there, and Pete Peters is lauding and claiming that God sent this Negro singer who is a wonderful singer to him.
Right.
And you can go to emmaheiser.christogenia.org and see it for yourself, because it's posted there.
Okay.
Did it say also that some of Cain's, which is a black, because somebody mentioned black in his, you know, out of Egypt,
okay,
did have that ability to sing and to be whatever. So,
let me ask you, has he done this again, or was this incident?
No, he hasn't. See,
oh,
what
okay.
happened is he was caught between a rock and a hard place, because how can he deny it? If they come in there, he's going to have the government all over him like nobody.
He was talking about how God sent this Negro to him,
right,
and how great a job he did.
Yeah, okay.
You can't
whitewash this, Gary. Yeah. This can't be whitewashed.
No, I've argued with Clifton Immenheiser about this because I remember when it happened. I said, Clifton, did you see this? Well, no, I got this tape. I said, did you know the whole thing behind it? Clifton says, I don't need to know that.
Okay. Well, yeah,
I watched the tape from one end to the other. It can't be denied. What you're saying is implausible.
Well, the man is
an embracer of Negroes.
If Pete Peters said that, he'd probably say, well, Yahweh created the situation and he's slithering out of it.
Right.
As well as he can. Oh. Yeah, okay. But no, I think Gary's right in saying he was between a rock and a hard place.
He can't say what he said.
Yeah,
he can't say what he said and be any kind of real Christian.
It sounded like he was showboating when he was saying stuff like that. But okay, here, we got one more verse to go and we're just past the hour. I got another show in half an hour, so.
We're going to listen to that too.
Right, so let's finish this up. Verse 26. And to Seth, to him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. Then began men to call upon the name of Yahweh. Fascinating. Okay, and so it was, who were these men, these Adamites, began to call upon the name of Yahweh.
Right,
and this,
because obviously Cain's descendants weren't doing that.
That's right. That's right. And all these people who think that Yahweh is a Canaanite God need to read this verse.
Also.
Yeah, okay. They're absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong. Okay. All right, so let's, Bill, let's continue. We're going to Genesis chapter 5. And, you know, whatever chapters you think, we certainly have to discuss chapter 6 because, you know, that's where the fallen angels mated with the daughters of men. And then,
I'd like to discuss 6 and then we should talk about the flood story a little bit.
Right.
I don't think we should carry waste a lot of time on it or spend a lot of time on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, you know, it's pretty cut and dry,
right.
I think. And then we should, but Genesis 6 is very important. The reason why Noah was preserved is very important.
Yes.
And Genesis chapter 10 is of utmost importance.
Right. Okay.
Well, it's like
chapter
10 question.
Is where history and archaeology and the Bible start to meet.
Right, right. Okay, Gary, you had one more comment or question?
Yes. I have talked to these Judeo jobs out here.
Okay.
And a lot of them say to me, when I mentioned the dual seed, that's impossible because the angels cannot mate with our women. You know, and I bring up this. But for some reason, even if you bring this up, they just got this mental block that can't happen. And I was just wondering if maybe you or Bill have ever ran into that.
Well, I think Jude and Peter addressed that, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to just reiterate that, Bill?
You know, this is the words of men against what's in Scripture and the way of Cain and the error of Balaam and the angels that left their first estate.
Right.
It's all very clear that all of that is connected to what Jude says is fornication, the pursuit of different flesh.
Right. And then Genesis chapter 6 clearly says that these sons of Elohim lusted after the daughters of men and came down from heaven. And that's why they left their first estate. So they were able to actually materialize. However, whether you consider it, angelic beings materializing into flesh beings, or whether you want to conceive of it as, space creatures, however you want to conceive of it, literal sexual relations took place. Otherwise, you couldn't have the offspring
between Adamites and non-Adamites.
That's right.
They created giants.
That's right.
Which gives us all the stories in the Bible about giants and all the myths about titans in our.
Yes.
Wider culture.
Right.
Well, I know that in Sodom and Gomorrah, when the angels came down, the men in the city, the Sodomites, wanted them.
Right.
Yeah.
It appears that they were flesh and they could be handled like flesh.
Right, exactly.
They ate. They come in and let me make you dinner.
Yeah.
They ate. They did everything.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's funny that, people will doubt this, and it does sound strange because it's not part of our daily experience, But remember, after Noah's flood, there was a big change in the atmosphere and the way the planet operated. The lifespans decreased, tremendously, from upwards of 600 years to only 120 years as an upward limit. So there was some sort of drastic change took place. And I think possibly that this fallen angel race, this was possibly the last incarnation of them. At least until, you know, some people believe it was coincident with Nibiru. Okay? And if that's the case, Nibiru's coming back.
Well, I don't know if I agree with all of that, but yes, you're right about the changes that took place in the earth and in the existence of man.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right about the fact that that was the last time that the beings themselves evidently hampered with us, because from that time on, both Jude and Peter say that they're bound in chains awaiting everlasting punishment.
That's right. That's right. And so that's going to happen on a judgment day. So there
was going on. More had to be going on a planet than just the flood story. But we'll discuss that when
we cover
the rest of Genesis.
All right. Okay.
I'd just like to say that I'm posting for the few people that can hear me in real time. I'm posting the balance of my New Testament translations.
Okay.
Mark, James, and Jude posted, and I'll have John and Peter up by this time tomorrow, probably a lot sooner than that.
Outstanding. So people can read a really good translation of the New Testament and compare it to the King James or, you know, any other version they want to compare it to. All right. Well, thank you, Gary, for joining the call. And, Bill, I thank you again for being my co-host this evening, and we'll attack this subject again, Genesis chapter 5, next Friday night. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, bless all. Keep tuning in and listen to you on Rick Adams. Everybody, listen to him on Rick Adams.
All right.
Yeah, please send me the link to somebody.
Radio.
Pardon?
Will somebody please send me the link to that?
Okay. I'll send it to you. Okay. All right.
It's RBM Radio.
Right. Okay. All right. Yeah, bless everybody.
Okay. Yeah, bless.